Today, on Rainbow Country, my exit interviews with Netta Kalantar and Emily Hawken from Big Brother Canada 5, and joining me live in studio, cannabis activist Mark Emery. Stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio Toronto Style right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, I'm Mayor John Tory, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
No matter who you are, no matter what you do, everyone has a story to tell. And right here on this LGBT show is where it all starts. We lift our voices, share our stories, and we'll raise our pride. After all, we've come a long way since 1969 and the Stonewall riots, to the legalization of same-sex marriage, to the recognition of trans equality. I'm Mark Tara. Join me on this journey through Rainbow Country. CIUT 89.5 FM. This is Rainbow Country, the station's gay radio show, giving voice to the LGBT community. I happen to be your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm Mark Tara. A little bit about me. I am an LGBT content creator. I'm also a recording artist. So get social, get interactive on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Mark Tara Music. Follow me, honey, I will follow you back. Want to be on the show? You have some ideas, some suggestions? You want to send me an email? mark@marktara.com. The podcast for Rainbow Country is on iTunes as well as on podomatic.com. And everything is hooked up through my website, marktara.com. marktara.com. So, this is episode 44. On this episode, my ongoing exit interviews from Big Brother Canada 5. Today we'll hear from Netta Kalantar and Emily Hawken. As well, joining me live in studio, the Prince of Pot himself, cannabis activist Mark Emery, will be joining me in just a few minutes. Stay tuned, because this journey through Rainbow Country begins right now with Big Brother Canada 5.
Hi, this is Carol Pope on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Excellent. Thank you for asking.
So, Emily,
You walk into the Big Brother Canada house and you see that you'll be playing, you realize you'll be playing with returning Big Brother Canada players. What went through your mind, Emily?
My initial reaction, I was so scared. There's some really intimidating players that came back. But also, like, I was really hoping that Gary would come back and, you know, to have him walk in last. I got really, really excited and I really wanted to work with Gary. But it was kind of like, it was kind of a surreal moment. But yeah, mixed emotions for sure.
So, Emily, yourself and Dylan, you guys became a duo, so to speak, in the group. Do you think you spent maybe too much time focused on Dylan, that you sort of neglected building relationships with the other house guests?
100%. I, you know, put all of my eggs in one basket, and I think that was in, like, that was kind of my downfall. Like, I stuck with Dylan. Obviously, he was like a huge threat in the house, like right off the bat. Well, just a target, I guess. But yeah, like, me spending so much time with Dylan, like, prevented me from making those, you know, relationships with the other house guests. And not that I had bad relationships with the other house guests, they just weren't even as, like, close to being as strong as with me and Dylan. So I think if I spread out my time a little more and I really tried with more people, that I don't think I would be sitting here talking to you right now.
So Dylan and yourself were on the block and your house guests voted to evict yourself, Emily. Why do you think they chose to keep such a big force in the house like Dylan as opposed to yourself? Talk to me about that. Why do you think that they did that?
Honestly, me blowing up at my so-called alliance, I don't think that helped my case. Do I regret it? No. Like, I was, you know, I was fired up. I think I had good reason to be mad at them. But, you know, he blew up on them, but just not to, like, the same degree. And I think that I'm a little more of a grudgy person than he is. He's just so fun-loving, and he's very forgiving. So, you know, like, he could be mad at you and then ask you, like, if you want him to make you food. Like, I'm just more like death stares. So I just think they thought they could reel him in. Like, their chances with me were kind of slim at getting me back. So I think they saw that and wanted to keep Dylan over me.
So my last question for you, Emily, would you play Big Brother again?
1,000% yes. I mean, with what I know now, I would obviously play a little differently. But it was the coolest, most amazing experience of my entire life. And if I had another opportunity to do it, 1,000% I would say yes.
Emily, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
So, Netta, you are a returning house guest. You played on both season 2 and season 5 of Big Brother Canada. Talk to me about how you changed up your gameplay from season 2 to now season 5. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I went in with a really specific strategy for season 2. I mean, I've been watching Big Brother since I was a kid. I watch UK, I watch US, I'm on freaking forums. Like, so I went in with a really specific strategy, lay low the first half of the game, build good connections, and then act as weak as possible, don't win any competitions, and kick it up in the second half of the game. And that's exactly what I did. This time, I knew I was going in with probably one of the largest targets on my back. Out of any of the returning bats. So I knew I couldn't play the same way. And you know what? The first time I went in, I really wanted to, like, play nice and stuff. And I tried doing that. I came out, I was still called an evil ice queen. So this time I went in, I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to embrace it. And I'm going to make all the big game moves I can. And if I don't really have a shot at winning this game, I might as well cause as much chaos as possible.
So Netta, Canada voted you the immunity, the safety, to be safe until jury. Looking back now on your gameplay in season 5, do you think you should have laid low a little bit more during your safety period? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, looking back on it now, it's easy for me to say I should have laid low, I shouldn't have done anything, but then I would have been accused by Canada or fans of getting dragged to the end of the game, or maybe I would have left in these big targets like Gary and Cassandra, who were going to be coming after me once my immunity was up, and were coming after Bruno and Kevin, who were two large key members of my alliance. And if they had taken them out and my immunity was up and I was with them left, maybe they would have taken me out. So I feel like there's no really right answer. I just did the best I could and it didn't work out.
So yourself and Aika, you were both on season two.
Yeah.
And now coming back to season five, why do you think you guys couldn't work together and stay loyal to each other?
There was a few things, really. Aika's a very difficult person to work with. It's very, like, emotionally draining working with her, because one morning you'll wake up and she's just not speaking to you and you don't know why, and then by the end of the night you guys are best friends again. But other than that, there was Dimitri kind of got in the way. And once a showmance kind of forms, you know that they will always choose each other over you, and they're always going to be strategizing without you. So, and because I knew that, like, with the connection I had with John in the house, how that does work. So I knew that I couldn't really fully trust her anymore. And then we kind of, the strategy of the six was to diverge and for half of us to take one side, which was Emily, Dylan, and those guys. And then the other half, which was Aika and Dimitri, to take Dre and William. So because we were trying to keep our own people safe while also staying in the alliance, we kind of were butting heads a lot. She wants to keep Dre and William safe. I want to keep Emily and Dylan safe. And that's where the main conflict really came from.
So Netta, my last question for you. Who do you think is in the best position right now to win Big Brother Canada 5?
I can't answer that. I feel like everyone's in the best position to win right now. Everyone has something going for them at this point in the game. Who deserves it? Again, I think everyone deserves it. I'm just like waiting for someone to really pull out some killer moves now. There's a lot of game to be left, so I can't choose at this point. There's just so much game left.
Netta Kalantar, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to CIUT's gay radio show, Rainbow Country, and I'm your host, Mark Tara. And that was my exit interviews with Netta and Emily from Big Brother Canada 5. Don't forget, you can see Big Brother on Global Mondays and Wednesdays at 9 p.m. and Thursdays at 8 p.m. But this Wednesday, it's on at 10 p.m. So, when I return live in studio, Mark Emery, stay with me.
This is City Councillor Kristen Wong Tam, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
And welcome back. So, he is a pot advocate, cannabis advocate. He's known as the Prince of Pot. He is Mark Emery. Welcome to the show, Mark Emery.
Hey, wonderful to be here at midnight.
I know. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here live in studio. Not a lot of people would be willing to do this.
Oh, really? It's still so much fun to be on the media, and I'm on all the time, but
yes,
it never
are.
Gets old, especially great old radio stations like this one where the smell of vinyl as you walk down the corridor just takes me back to when I was in London, Ontario at CHRW, and I had a show there for 2 years from 1989 to 91, the good times.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh, I love that. That was a wonderful thing. It was the only job in my life I've ever been fired from, though. But I think every, you know, I love those moves like Pump Up the Volume mm-hmm. and FM and stuff like that. So the only really good way to ever leave a radio station is to be fired and dragged out.
Now, our first segment there, I just played some exit interviews from Big Brother Canada, and you were saying that you know Sarah Hanlon, the winner.
She worked at Vapor Central, and she's well-known. She was well-known in the cannabis movement, but then she's become a journalist and writing regularly for 24 hours now since her Big Brother experience. And so she's doing quite well, and she writes about cannabis issues. But it was just an interesting coincidence that you were talking to the exit players on Big Brother, and that Sarah happens to have won Big Brother.
I know.
That's from Toronto here.
Yeah. So, Mark, yourself and your wife, Jody, a few weeks ago, you guys had an incident. You guys were going to an expo, I believe.
Well, it was more than an incident. I wish it was just an incident.
Exactly.
But they were,
at
like,
Pearson.
Raiding and seizing all our stores and assets and going through our apartments, hers in Vancouver, mine here, and stores.
Talk to me about what happened at Pearson.
Well, that was just their dramatic way of making the arrest. They probably could have arrested me earlier in the day or when. I'm not actually sure why they even let me stay in business selling marijuana. We had the busiest marijuana store in the world, 461 Church in the Village. Wonderful place. Best shop I ever had. Best job I ever had. But I was doing it for 6.5 months. And we sold a lot of marijuana to like 12,000 people every week. It was just the busiest place on earth. And I don't know why they let me keep doing it for so long. It was such a wonderful thing. But in any case, they did let me do it. But then on March 8th, you know, they basically raided our facilities all across Canada. And they started with arresting me and Jody that evening at Pearson. Right. Wednesday night it was, March 8th. And I was just getting ready. We were just going to go to Spanibus, which is the world's largest marijuana expo in Barcelona. Because in Barcelona, they have these cannabis social clubs. So they have quite the scene in Spain. And in fact, Spain produces most of the marijuana for the entire continent of Europe, certainly Western Europe. They're producing prodigious amounts, much like Canada, of seeds and cannabis in Spain. So a lot of industry activity tends to center there. And then we were going to go spend 8 days in Florence and Rome.
Wow.
And I've been in Florence last year, and it was wonderful for a week. And I thought I'd take Jody there and to Rome, which we have never seen. And that got derailed. And now they've taken my passport, which, you know, they can do when you've got some charges. And now I won't be able to travel abroad for a while.
Right.
Although I could get that changed. It's not like I ever don't appear in court. I mean, I've been arrested 30 times for cannabis-related offense, and I've spent 6 years in 36 different facilities throughout the United States and Canada. I've been arrested and jailed in 9 out of 10 provinces, 6 U.S. states. You know, so I've been around. It's not like I'm not eager to show up in court. I am. I don't mind even going to jail for years. It's not like a problem for me. So it's not like they really need to put too many bail conditions on me in order to get me to show up, because the purpose of bail is to ensure I don't, quote, reoffend prior to my trial. And then I make sure I show up for court. Well, I was on bail for 5 years before my extradition to the U.S. in 2010, where I did the 5-year bit there for the selling of seeds. So, you know, for 5 years I was on bail and I always showed up in court and agreed to get extradited and all those other things, right? Because for me, it's all about a process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care how long I go to jail for, because in the long run, it all works to the advantage of our movement. So that's good.
So that happened to you a few weeks ago. Let's take a step back. Talk to me about why you became a cannabis activist. What was it that inspired you, that triggered you, that sort of thing, to get involved?
Well, back in I started smoking pot on December 21st, 1980, and I found that a profound experience. And I read Ayn Rand exactly a year before, and I found that a profound experience. And then the two experiences became synthesized into one. And starting seriously, though, in 1990, I looked around at the cannabis movement. I kept seeing people getting arrested, and I thought cannabis was such a wonderful thing. It didn't make sense to me. I couldn't understand. And yet there was no organized political activity that I could determine in Canada trying to legalize marijuana. And then in 1990, the straw that broke the camel's back for me to decide to do a lot of work on this was when the government of Canada banned all books and magazines about marijuana. And you couldn't buy The Emperor Wears No Clothes by Jack Herrera, and you couldn't get High Times magazine on the newsstand. And the RCMP had just raided the warehouse of Firefly or Rainforest Books that published Grow Your Own Stone, and the RCMP had actually seized the warehouse of 5,000 copies. And I thought, wow, this is serious stuff, seizing books and magazines and banning all information about marijuana. So I decided, and by the way, I became aware of that when I was at CHRW down the highway at, in London, and I had my little radio show, and I used to love playing the Dead Kennedys, Jello Biafra's punk band, and then he did spoken word things, and then in his double CD, I remember it's release called I Blow Minds for a Living, he's got this segment called Grow More Pot, where he says, I don't smoke pot, but we've been lied to as to the history of pot, and there's this incredible book out called The Emperor Wears No Clothes that talks about the conspiracy against the cannabis people. And, well, certainly to buttress that, there was a conspiracy in Canada because the book was banned. And then from that point, it took me 4 years to strike down that law that forbids books and magazines about marijuana, although it's still in the criminal code. But, I mean, it was struck down in the Ontario Superior Court by Judge J. Ellen MacDonald in 1994, and that's one of the first things when people say, well, what have you achieved? Well, I made books and magazines for you, legal, and that we did by getting charged giving out pamphlets to students after they'd had a narc in their school arresting 50 of them for selling weed to this attractive undercover officer they put in the high school. And she got pretty well every male she encountered, because she was attractive, to sell her weed, and then they charged everybody, 52 students. I thought this was a terrible, egregious, and horrible thing to exist in a so-called free society. So we gave out pamphlets in front of the school after school, and the principal called the police, and they came and charged us for disseminating illicit drug literature. And the pamphlet was called 10 Questions and Answers Every Parent, Teacher, and Student Should Know About Marijuana. And that was as ordinary and dry as you can get. We went to court over it. Unfortunately, as I expected, we won. And then I proceeded to get bongs and pipes established again. The government had run those people all out of business. In the 70s, a lot of the shops along Yonge Street, for example, Toronto, and there were hundreds of them selling paraphernalia, but they were typically owned by Pakistani or East Indian people, and they were easy to demonize and easy to sort of pass laws with the idea that these insidious foreigners are corrupting and poisoning our youth. That's, they're less able to do that now. We live in a more multicultural society, but it was also very kind of ubiquitous in those days to go into places on Yonge Street that had a blue, you know, black light posters, incense, a lot of carving stuff from India, and more cocaine paraphernalia than you typically see now, too. So it was really big in the time, but it's not like anybody was complaining, but the 80s overall were a general reaction to things, especially in the gay community with the AIDS explosion that became a really critical problem by 1983. And so you've got fear of sexuality, fear of drugs, you know, fear of foreigners, all these kind of different influences coming along in the 80s, right? And worship of making money. So it was an interesting period. And my shop, we had those wonderful commemorations for the Stonewall riots in 69 and the Bathhouse Rebellion in 1980. And it was wonderful working in the gay community, because I was surrounded by so much politics and so much history, especially on the church and the village there. And so we had commemorations on the wall to various aspects of our mutual history, like the LaDain Commission. And the movie I was in, it was half about me trying to legalize pot and half about the Michaels trying to get gay marriage legalized.
Really?
What's it called? Yeah, what is the movie I'm in, 2008? It's called Escape to Canada.
Okay.
And it's half me and it's half the Michaels, and it's like the year 2003 in Canada when Canada got cool.
Wow.
At least how it looked then. Now, gay marriage, they succeeded in getting that, whereas I was on the threshold of it, and it was briefly legal, but they brought it back. There's a real establishment determination to keep pot criminalized that often eludes logic or reason, but then it's because you realize the pot people are the free thinkers. And in the old days, oddly enough, it was the gay community that were the free thinkers. But it's important that you're a free thinker when you're an outlaw, but once you're welcomed into the community, it's difficult to be a free thinker, because then you have a vested interest in getting along. Oh, everybody loves me, I'm getting along, why would I want to offend everybody? When you're an outlaw or an outcast, when you're on the outside anyway, it's all you can do to get their attention to be aggressive and on the outside and this sort of thing. So that's why even after I've been doing this for, 27 years, you know, I'm still an outsider trying to break into the establishment elite. Right. And at various times they all pander to me. But it's just I see people neutered once they're on the inside. People say you can't change anything unless they're on the inside. But when they get on the inside, I never see them change anything. It seems to be this sort of like incremental, you know, by the time I die, parts of marijuana might be legal, you know, type thing. Really, it had to take that long? It's already 27 years? Wow.
Well, I think this would be a perfect time Mark, for us to take a little break. And let's check out some Rick James, shall we?
Oh, sure.
Okay, we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
CIUT, and you're listening to the station's gay radio show, Rainbow Country. And live in studio is Mark Emery, cannabis activist. Welcome back.
Oh, it's nice to be back. You know, this song makes me think of those early 80s days. We just need a joint and someone to make out with. And that's a grooving song, that one. Makes me think also, too, of a song I've been humming lately, the Mary Jane Girls, this female band. They were all weed girls. They were all these hotties. And they had a great song called In My House.
Yes.
And that was a fun. And that was his answer to, he was having a rivalry with Prince, and they had the Vanity Six. So Vanity is the lead singer there. And both of them have come to unfortunate ends, too, as a coincidence between Rick James and Prince, two greatly talented people. Rick James is greatly underappreciated. And unfortunately, Dave Chappelle's mocking portrait of him, which is hilarious, Rick James, bitch, is kind of overshadowed Rick James's actual legacy, because it's 35 years ago now. Super Freak came out in 82, 83. And hard to believe it's been that long.
Yeah, I know, eh? Let's talk about you and selling pot seeds in 2010, I believe.
Well, I got extradited in 2010, but I sold them from 1995 to 2005. And the only reason I sold them, which is kind of a similar reason, the only reason I sold weed is to make some political points.
Right.
I came up with this revolutionary idea that in order to have and you'll find this interesting. In order to have an effective revolution where we legalize marijuana, we need to recreate our entire cultural delivery systems, I guess. And what I wanted to do is, oddly enough, adopt measures used by both the IRA and the gay and feminist movements. And what we needed, I said, was we need to have money. We need political power. We need economic power. We need to have businesses that are funneling money towards political objectives. And then we need media. We don't have any media representatives, so nobody talks on our behalf. There's no way. This is before the internet, 1990. And so I thought we need magazines. We need books, but they're banned. So we have to get that solved, and then we have to get our own media. We had radio shows, internet shows. But at first, we started with my magazine in 1994. Then we need a political entity. We need money, we need media, and we need political entities. I mean, these were all things I was proposing we need ourselves. We can't rely on others to give us a voice.
Right.
We need to create our own media. We need to create political parties. So I came up with the BC Marijuana Party and the Canadian Marijuana Party in the year 2000 because nobody was listening to us. And then I said, and then we need to recruit. We need a more active and visible forms of recruitment. So we developed 420 in 1994, Cannabis Day in 1994. And then dovetailing into our politics, our media, was the idea of a capitalist and activist revolution. We need stores all across Canada so they can funnel information, so they can be a central distribution point to books, magazines, bongs, pipes, all these things were illegal. And then we need to encourage everyone to become a capitalist. The problem in 1990 when I started was that everybody who was associated with legalizing marijuana was essentially a hippie living off the 70s, right? Living the 70s dream. And I said, well, that's just not going to work. That's not how things change. Usually idealists get crushed. So if we're going to stay idealists, we need to adopt the dress and mode of the society of oppressors. So we need to make money. We need to become in business. We need to get in politics. We need to get in media. We need to create our own media. We need our own businesses. We need to empower ourselves, essentially. So whatever talent we've got, it has to be harnessed towards the movement. So musicians sing songs about weed. Entrepreneurs open stores about weed. People who like politics and go to school, get political science degrees, get legal degrees. I put Kirk Tusaw, Canada's most famous marijuana lawyer, through school for a year back in 2004 to get his Canadian degree, right? I was looking down the road at these kind of things. We're going to need dedicated lawyers who are geniuses, who are going to create change and devote themselves entirely to Canada. So I was paying to train lawyers. I was doing all these great things. We had the Hemp BC Legal Assistance Center in 1996, 97, just to help people for free and train lawyers to work with Canada. So I tried to develop this infrastructure that could spread organically across Canada. And to that degree, I was largely successful. I do like what's happened in our industry, in our movement, in our culture, all these great things. Everybody's growing pot. I sold 5 million seeds in those 10 years from 1995 to 2005. I gave away $5 million. It was awesome for ballot initiatives in the U.S., class action suits, giving money away to political parties around the world, including like U.S. political parties. And I remember I gave money to the Legalized Cannabis Party in New Zealand. I bought half-page ads in all their newspapers the week of the election. It was amazing that I could actually get so involved in the affairs of other countries, right? But so that's fun.
You mentioned 420. Did you have something to do with that?
Oh, we started that. Now, 4:20 in the afternoon is a time to smoke pot, started in California in the late 70s.
Okay.
But nobody was doing anything on April 20th, and I can only take credit through the back door because when I first opened my shop in Vancouver, Hemp BC, in 1994, I ended up hiring the most keen people in those days and irrepressibly happy, wonderful. We're all deadheads, people who were on Dead Tour. I used to love those people. But so I hired Dana Rozek and Cindy Lasser, two of these people, and they worked in my shop, and we had a wonderful little time in our little shop. And I was alarmed. As soon as I hired them, one day at 4:20, probably the first day they worked there, They went, 420, smoke them if you got them, and they all lit up. And I'd never heard this. And I'm from Ontario here, and I told them, what is this 420, smoke them if you got them? I said, because I'm from Ontario, and we've never, I don't know anything about a 420, so what's that? Right. And they said, well, 420 is the time where you smoke pot every day. And if you want to know who the hip people are, they said, you just ask, what time is it? And if they say 420, you know they're potheads. And if they give you the real time, then they're just straights, right? And so, okay, that's cool. And then, and so I got used to them smoking and saying it's 420 every day. Mm. And then one day, Cindy and Dana came up to me and said, Mark, it's April 20th coming up in the park next door. We had a lovely park in Vancouver, Hemp. We call it, it's Victory Square, but we call it Hemp for Victory Square. And they said, can we have a celebration in the park for 420, April 20th? And I go, what do you mean? She said, well, we'll just, you know, set up a microphone and a bit of a stage and we'll play music and we'll smoke pot all day. And I go, smoke pot all day? Like why? And they said, because it's 420. I said, you mean just hedonistically smoke pot and try and get away with it in a public park all day? And they said, yeah. And I said, no, that's decadent. That's you know. And my Ayn Randian side was coming out there. You know, the whole idea that we'd somehow promote a hedonistic smoke out at the park just seemed like outrageous, right? So anyway, I say no. So they go back and they have a discussion. They come back to me about a half hour later. I love how this developed. And they said, well, Mark, even if you don't approve, can we do it anyway? And I thought, well, I do admire initiative. So, yes, you can go ahead and do it anyway. And then half an hour later, after they consult each other, they come back, well, Mark, can you help us? And essentially, so eventually I did it all. So because we had all the cables coming out of our store going down the street half a block with all these, and then to provide the power for the stage. And then we provided them with all the seed money and everything they needed to essentially put the 420 on. So I'd always, Cindy Lass, who has since died, and I always try and credit her and Dana with being the originators of the 420. But definitely started in Canada, and now it's spread all over the world. Toronto has a huge one, and Vancouver's had the longest one now for 23 years. And but it's everywhere in the world, just like we started the Global Marijuana March, too. Dana Beals started that, and we financed it for the first 5 years. We printed the posters off for every country around the world and shipped them from Canada. Wow. It used to cost me $35,000 a year from 1999 to about 2004. But the Global Marijuana March is very big in Toronto, too, and that also started in Vancouver and started with our organization, both the 420 and Global Marijuana March. And we're responsible for lots of the things you see in the world. Certainly, when I was brought to the United States for extradited there to face my U.S. Justice Department charges of conspiring to create marijuana for Americans. But they said this man has provided America with 4 million seeds, and that's, you know, provided several megatons of pot and will continue to do so for many years. And it sounded really bad. And the bottom, and at the end of it, they said Mr. Emery is responsible for more marijuana than anyone ever brought before the U.S. criminal justice system. Which, fortunately, I was fortunate that I'd already agreed on a 5-year term, because it started out at 28 to 40 years. When you're the number one guy, the biggest producer of marijuana in the history of the U.S. criminal justice system, they tend to want life and all that. But in order to extradite me, they kept offering me inducements. So eventually it comes down to 5 years, and that's what I do serve there. But the amount of marijuana I have been responsible for producing in Canada and the United States is prodigious. And that was also part of what we had to do. We had to provide more money for our culture, which means we needed to grow a lot more pot. And my seeds helped facilitate that. And then it would facilitate an advancement in our industry. People would get more knowledgeable, because eventually I was finding genetics from all over the world, getting them out there, so that Canadians and Americans were essentially getting the best possible genetics in a very competitive environment, where now North America and Spain dominate world production, along with Canada, of incredible marijuana. The best marijuana in the world comes from the United States, Canada, and Spain. And in between Canada and Spain, Canada is superior as well. So it's quite possible we're, without question, the best marijuana in the world here. In certainly British Columbia, but certainly Canada. And so generally what my philosophy is, earn money and then give it out. You know, spread it around. I did that with my shop on Church Street. Man, we gave away such a fortune in the last, about $250,000 I gave away from December to March. And then on top of that, we gave $500,000 to the government in HST taxes and payroll deduction taxes. So we were giving money to gay organizations, queer organizations in the village. We were giving to Amnesty International large amounts of money. We were giving reporters, journalists, activists all around the world in a lot of different fields and disciplines money.
Right.
And it was because I figured if I got arrested, the cops would take it all and I would have been right.
Right.
So as it turns out, on the 8th, not only were they putting me in jail, but they were raiding my apartment, and I only had 15 grand there. It's not like I live a particularly decadent life, so it wasn't like a lot was required.
Right.
And we gave away, like I say, such an amount. You know, I was giving it away like crazy, so I wouldn't be stuck having it.
So one piece, because I think it's on Thursday, 4/20.
Yes, it's 2 days away. We're literally like 36 hours away from the celebration beginning on Thursday.
I think it's in Toronto. It's Dundas Square.
Dundas and Yonge Square. Yes, Yonge Square. And it's the last year. It'll be at Nathan Phillips Square next year.
Really?
But yeah, it's too big. Tomorrow, it's going to rain, I think, a little bit on Thursday. I hope not. It often is cold and rainy here in Toronto for 4/20. But otherwise, if it was sunny, it would be just packed. They would have to close down that intersection, I think.
One piece of advice for anyone going on Thursday.
Well, if it's raining, I would say bring an umbrella. But umbrellas are unwieldy and you have to carry them and they're easy to lose. But they're also cheap, so if you lost it, it wouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anything more miserable than a cold, rainy Toronto day and you're trying to act like you're having fun when you're freezing and you've got to go pee and there's nowhere to go pee and all these different things that happen when you get cold and chilled and wet.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's all about the weather. If the weather's great, everybody's going to have an awesome time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly rolling up a lot of joints.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually on bail, so I was forbidden from smoking marijuana, so I had to go. The government basically forces your coercion or coerces you into obeying the state anyway, because they said, well, you can't have any marijuana, you can't sell it, you can't go into dispensaries, you can't smoke it unless you have a legal permission. So I've actually gotten legal now, so I have my legal little card, and I'm allowed to carry around like a lot, 150 grams, and possess a whole bunch, way more than what they're proposing for everyone in this new legal society that's coming up in 18 months. So if you're really interested in possessing marijuana all or anywhere in Canada and being able to have more than a good supply, and you want to grow your own, it's so easy to get all that now.
So let's talk about what's potentially going to happen in like a year. The Liberal government just tabled some legislation?
They have, and it does
So what are your thoughts on all of this?
There's a few good things, but oddly enough, only a few.
Mm-hmm.
That you'll be able to have 30 grams, you know.
And four plants?
Well, here's the thing with the four plants, though. The four plants are so dicey. Because
not five,
four. I mean, and the thing is, that none of these things will really survive a court challenge, because why is it moral to grow four plants but not 40?
Right.
And why can you only have 30 grams? Why not 1,000 grams, 1,000,000 grams? You can have an unlimited amount of tobacco in your home. You can have an unlimited amount of alcohol in your home. You can make your own wine. You can make your own beer. You can make as much. And no one inspects you. Nobody's coming to your house to check your little wine, you know, cellar or your homebrew beer. Or even if you grow tobacco in your backyard, nobody's coming to ever care what you do, right? And those things are far more harmful than marijuana. And marijuana has got all these regulations attached to it, like it's plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is, what they're doing is they're not really legalizing it. They've decided that they got lost control of the prohibition. People like me were setting the agenda. We were opening stores. We were selling marijuana. We were sort of dictating how the terms were. In other words, we're going to do this, and that's what I always say. This is my way of, this is what legalization looks like. I'm going to show the world what my idea of legalization operates like. Invite people to come in. I'll rent stores. We'll start a chain. We'll have hundreds of them across Canada. And by the time next year rolls around, my idea was that we would like have what people already wanted, which was to buy in a store in their neighborhood with 30, 35 varieties, with people who love weed, who are going to tell them all about the product, who have a lot of pride in their product, and know all the good people and connections. And that's basically what we were trying to establish. Now, that's the right model.
Mm-hmm.
We did 12,000 people a week in the village. Like, we had the busiest marijuana shop in the world.
Why do you think that particular store was so busy for you?
Well, first of all, it was my only shop. It was the only one I ran. I worked there every day. It was wonderful. It was the best job ever. Gay men especially, but gay people generally smoke pot probably more than, say, straight society, I've got to figure. It's a party district. And actually, a lot of people live around there. And it's a nice place. I live there. I live on Alexander between Young and Church. So I live like steps away from my place. And it's we're filled with residential high-rises. And it was just such a beautiful thing. It was convenient for people who didn't live in the neighborhood to come by. And it was really convenient for the people who did live there to come by. Plus, we hired a lot of gay and queer people. I myself identify as a variety of things that depending on what, you know, where I am, what time and all these sort of things. Right. So I felt so comfortable in that environment, that milieu. But, you know, I think any shop I have would be popular. But that was the most magical, beautiful place ever. And I'm always going to have such a fond remembrance of it. I'd like to open them again. And as soon as I get these charges cleared, I'll start breaking the law again and open other shops and probably get arrested. And
do you think you will be? Like, will that location open up again, you think?
Well, I don't know what it's going to be. But the landlord eventually was pressured so intensely to change. But he quite frankly liked us, and he loved what we did to his building and renovated it and cleaned it up after the pizza place.
I have to share with you, Mark Emery. I do this online show which has now gone on to Rogers TV, and we film upstairs at Erotico like a couple Sundays a month. And before you guys moved in, we would walk in, you know, blah blah blah, set up, film, whatever. When you guys moved in, we walked in. It's like everyone breathed deeply.
Yes,
because it would permeate the upstairs.
Yeah, we eventually improved the ventilation considerably. We were always kind of paying attention.
We weren't complaining, Mark.
Well,
Emery.
No, and even it flashed next door. It's not so much like the staff wanted to complain. The owner kind of complained that, but we beefed up the exhaust fans and stuff. Yeah. It was such a great thing. We eventually had drag shows there, beautiful drag shows, and I just loved all the customers, and it was a perfect job. Now I'm kind of unemployed. I'm not used to like having that much spare time, so I'm glad at least we have a lot of Jays and Raptors and Leaf games to watch till I figure out what I'm going to do. Because I'm restricted to Ontario right now, too, so I can't even schedule a national tour. There's a lot of places in Canada I haven't been to since my farewell tour in 2009, where I visited 35 cities and said goodbye, and then I was off and came back 5 years later. So I'm going to, in June, July, probably going to tour Canada. And
what?
Oh, just talk to people about this new legislation. I can usually get an audience of 200-300 people, and it would be good to go across Canada, explain to them what I think about this legislation and how cynical the government's gotten. See, when I think legalization, what I've been working for is really just a stroke of the pen. One sentence, you know, Mr. Speaker, the government has removed cannabis from the schedule of controlled drugs and substances. Well, once they do that, it's essentially legal. And then people like me, I was paying the HST anyway, but essentially what they would do is everybody would have to do whatever they're doing now, honestly, peacefully, and pay all your taxes and obey reasonable regulation.
Right.
But instead, the government has made it this extraordinarily complex thing requiring 300 pages of legislation, endless little qualifications and loopholes and additional criminalizations. Like if a 19-year-old gives weed to a 17-year-old, he could get up to 14 years in jail. I mean, it's crazy, right? Fortunately, they're not going to imprison like young people, 18 and under, but just anybody who supplies them with weed. Well, for example, you go to 420 on Thursday, people are going to be sharing joints like crazy. In fact, we tend to throw out thousands of joints. So if some 17-year-old in the audience gets them, all of a sudden, you know, whoever threw out the joints facing 40 years, it's all nuts because there's no reason for anybody to fear marijuana, for anybody of any age. Mm-hmm. Marijuana is, without question, one of the safest substances on earth. It has no capacity to kill you. It has no capacity to get you addicted. It really is not that mysterious how it works or operates.
So let me ask you about that. Is smoking pot, is it addictive? Or is it the habit that becomes addictive?
Well, lifestyle choices we make that are pleasurable, we say we're habituated to it. Addiction is when it gets in the way of all the other aspects of your life. So does marijuana have the power to upset your life, take all your money maybe, make you smoke a lot of weed, make you lazy. I don't agree it does. I think if you're lazy, you don't need marijuana to make you lazy. And if you're motivated, marijuana can really inform you. Like some of the greatest creators in the world, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, these are all marijuana people. Most marijuana people who are musicians or performance artists or actors mm-hmm. or film directors are very, very busy people. Mm-hmm. Even radio producers, entertainment producers. I mean, I've never been around lazy people because they're energy drainers. I'm not interested in lazy people. So I've never been around them. I'm 59 years old. I've been smoking for what, since 1980, so 36-37 years. I've just never been around lazy people, so I don't know all these myths and cliches that I hear spouted every now and then. Like, I want to get to the point, to the myth of impairment, that marijuana is impairing. If marijuana impaired you, I would not advocate for it. I'm not going to advocate for something that makes you stupider or foolish or dangerous or immoral. Those things are already out there legal, like alcohol. That'll make you immoral. I mean, if I were talking to parents right now, I would say be grateful if your teenager wants to go to marijuana. In fact, I would say give him the marijuana, give her the marijuana, because your daughter or son, first of all, your daughter's never going to get raped by anybody smoking a joint. We're unlike the alcohol or coke people. Right. You know, there's no danger to marijuana like there is huffing gas or doing methamphetamines, and it's bad enough that 5% of all our 10-year-old boys in Ontario are on Ritalin or some methamphetamine mm-hmm. that they've given them, and we're getting them addicted at young ages. And at the same time, marijuana extracted oil is being used to treat tens of thousands of epileptic children throughout North America.
Did you see the CNN, what is it called, Weed?
Yeah, that's the Sanjay Gupta.
Yes, did you
see
that?
They're amazing. But I've met many of those people. I've gone to expos all over the world and met many epileptics and many nurses and doctors who work with people with spasticity disorders mm-hmm. and what have you. And marijuana has something to offer almost everybody in a therapeutic way.
Right.
And so the idea that marijuana is this thing we need to control and worry about and regulate, and then, of course, not curiously enough to allow market stockholders or market shareholders or businesses that have been, you know, created anew to exploit an industry, that is totally unnecessary. We already have an industry. The marijuana is already being grown, sold, consumed, and has been for 50 years by millions of Canadians. We have all that figured out. So the government attempting to usurp our culture, which they won't acknowledge it's a culture, they won't give us an apology for 50 years of a policy that was bigoted and only served to punish us. If you ask a politician, they'll never tell you what the purpose of marijuana prohibition is. And if they say, oh, it's to keep marijuana out of the hands of children, you point out, well, how can you justify criminalizing 2 million Canadians, all adults, mm-hmm. not children, for such flimsy explanations as that? How did you jail hundreds of thousands of people, sometimes in my case for years, months and years? How can you justify that by this vague thing that somehow we have to protect the children? So in other words, there was never any reason for marijuana prohibition. It's just been a plain bigotry. The government's been oppressing us. The cops have been oppressing us. So the same people who've been oppressing us are now making these rules. These rules weren't made by anybody who smokes pot. Ann McClellan doesn't smoke pot. Mark Ware doesn't smoke pot. Mm. Bill Blair doesn't smoke pot. Justin Trudeau says he hasn't smoked pot since 2008. All these rules and regulations and punishments are being meted out by people who essentially have always disliked and been hostile to us. Right, so this is just their way of converting their hostility into a socially acceptable form of mm-hmm. hostility. Right, it's passive aggressive. Before they were the aggressive, now they're going to be the passively oppressive. Right, they're going to still arrest us. They're going to still do all these bad things, but they're going to call it legalization, which right. is the insidious thing.
So, fast forward a year from now, potentially, pot will become legal.
Yeah,
how do you see that playing out?
Well, ideally, I'd like to see that we're going to win all our court challenges and that all of us who are Canadians will be able to participate in this industry and that we'll have Shoppers Drug Mart selling medical marijuana.
Do you think it'll go through the drugstores?
Oh, no. I don't mean in a monopolistic sense. I mean everybody should be entitled. I'm sure Shoppers wants to handle medical okay. marijuana. I know somebody in the Weston family. They very much want to handle medical marijuana. I'm sure the LCBO will want to handle it. I'm sure there will be small boutique shops like I ran that would do extremely well and pay many taxes and things. I see when all Canadians are invited into an industry that we can all grow it, we can all sell it, we can all consume it, we can have unlimited number of plants. the prices are going to plummet, for one. In a true era of legalization, our Canadian farmers with their thousands of hectares of land, they are going to produce marijuana at pennies a gram, right? So that it can be sold for $1 or $2 a gram. That's what it would be like if it's really legalized. Mm-hmm. But what I see is a controlled prohibition to keep the price high, to keep taxes high, to keep the players, the corporate elite that are hand in glove with government, mm-hmm. and that all the pioneers and people who broke the law and went to court and made all this possible are going to be ignored. That's my fear. So we'll see. But, you know, it's basically the same job as ever. I've got to break the law and go out and advocate and do what I think is right in order to see the political landscape I want. And that's what you have to do.
And potentially go on tour.
Well, go on tour, break the law, explain to people, be willing to, and at the same time,
raise
be patient.
Awareness.
You know, we're in this era where we're supposed to be getting legalization.
Right.
It might take longer to get it right than we had hoped. But mm-hmm. then, you know, it's all a struggle. You know, it's good that there's a struggle out there. I think it's important for humans to have to fight for liberty at all times, because if we take it for granted, we lose the ability to fight for it. So we need to stay politically active and stay self-aware.
Sure.
And we need to know who our oppressors are and how we can best, you know, get them on our side. It's not always easy. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of power. The purpose of government is to control its citizens. So by giving us freedom, it's kind of the reverse of their mandate.
Right.
Their mandate is to control us and tell us right. how to live. And that's why marijuana people are targeted, because we're the free thinkers. We've been the people that don't buy into dogma. We don't buy political dogmas, religious dogmas,
right.
or even dogmas and labels about who we are as individuals. We tend to have our own opinions about that. And governments don't like that. They want conformists. They need obedient citizens who are going to do what the government says.
Mm-hmm.
And free thinkers tend not to go that way. That was always the problem with the gay community too, is that, you know, they're just outsiders by their very orientation, their very nature,
sure.
and they're not going to be corralled successfully into this uniformity and orthodoxy that people would like to see.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, Canada's not that culture. I mean, it would be so difficult. It's difficult to be a cannabis activist in Japan in the same way that everybody there is essentially the same race. It's a very mm-hmm. homogenous society.
Mm-hmm.
Change is very hard in homogeneity. Whereas
when
you
have say.
When you have multiculture,
right.
you are a lot more chance of making legitimate change.
Mark Emery, thank you so much. This has been so enlightening for me to have your wisdom here. So
hey,
thank
I'm glad
you.
To hear you say so. That's so sweet.
And I hope you will come back again. And
anytime you invite me, I'd be back.
Excellent. Thanks again for your time, Mark.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I want to talk. Pass the joint. I was born a city they call Buffalo. 0 degrees below. It's too damn cold and funky. Mama raised me on the knuckles racket. With big kids and no father. She said she couldn't hack it. On the east side, where I started swinging. On the corners hanging. Out with all the hoodlum. Pass the joint. Now the love that I find in the shifter. Shook your crying pity. Ain't no love for brothers. Pass the joint. Pass the joint. I think I want to talk about the place I was born. I was torn. I said, pass the joint. Give me one more hit. I ain't finished with it. I got some more to say. Now the players hanging around the main strip. Acting like they own a trip. If they had my cash, they could be hip. Strange, the gossip is so tragic. They call me a faggot. And me and all my women laugh at it. Love. They really keep me dancing, keep me really laughing. In the country, me, my dog, and horses, hanging out with my family, talking about Stone City. Say, pass the joint. I think I want to talk about the place I was born. I was torn. Say, pass the joint. I need me one more hit. I ain't finished with it. I got some more to say. Need to talk. City I was born. I wish they wouldn't be so torn. I wanna talk. Sure that I was bred. Need to talk. But I'm sure that that has led me to my fame. I was born a city they call Buffalo. 0 degrees below. It's too damn cool and funky. I think I wanna talk about it. Pass the joint.